and welcome to this episode. We're going to be running through the management of anaphylaxis as the RESUS Council guidelines have recently changed last year. So we're going to just update you all on those new changes.
So what is anaphylaxis? It's a severe, life-threatening and a generalised hypersensitivity reaction. It's a really acute onset of life-threatening airway breathing and circulation problems, usually but not always associated with skin or mucosal changes. I think the thing that's most scary about it is that you can be just chatting to a person 1 minute and then they suddenly, almost in front of your eyes, just start swelling up, their tongue goes a bit flat and they start lifting a little bit. And then they may get some stridor or something like that and go hypotensive. And it just happens within seconds.
The speed is the scary thing.
Reassuringly, only 20 deaths occur each year in the UK.
Is that reassuring?
I think so. Because there's a lot of people out there with that severe anaphylactic reactions and allergies. So we must be really good at treating it. Look on the bright side, Dr. Young.
That's right.
Is that because we've got so many people out there with their EpiPens who are self-injecting their adrenaline? I'd be interested to know how many more deaths we'd have from anaphylaxis if we didn't treat it well.
No one's going to fund that study, though.
Shame.
It's annoying when ethics get in the way of science. Should we talk a bit about some pathophysiology then? So anaphylaxis can be allergic or non-allergic. Majority of times it's an allergic cause driven by a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. Now here you get sort of an antigen that binds to an antibody, and this causes mast cell activation and mast cell degranulation. Now this releases a host of mediators, predominantly histamine, but also things like leukotrienes, cytokines, and other things that you don't really need to know about. The key clinical consequences for the patient is that you get some bronchospasm, mainly from the histamine release. You get decreased vascular tone and increased capillary permeability. Now, the decreased vascular tone is obviously going to drop your blood pressure, and the increased capillary permeability is going to cause fluid shifts from the intravascular space to the extravascular tissues, which is going to, A, cause hypertension, but also is going to help generate that rash that is quite common. The other thing to be aware of are the non-allergic causes. Now, these are, again, sort of IgE-mediated causes, so they do come under the type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. But they're often what's known as hereditary angioedemas, so this is things like C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency. You would differentiate this from normal anaphylaxis in that you generally only get airway signs, so you only really get laryngeal edema, only really get stridor, you don't get peripheral features, you often don't get the rash. And you treat them differently as well. They won't respond to adrenaline. So certainly the C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency, essentially we give them C1 esterase, which is, I think it's called Berinet or something. It's a very posh, very expensive drug. Otherwise, you can use things like FFP, which actually have a little bit easier to get for most emergency departments. But I think if you're ever in doubt, the advice is always just to treat it for anaphylaxis. So if you're unsure, don't try and be clever. Just give them some adrenaline.
Is it quite hard to recognise first time around? Because you won't know they've got... You won't necessarily know they've got that hereditary.
No, I've seen it once, and I knew it was that because the patient told me that they had C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency.
So why that's helpful.
That's very helpful.
That's very helpful.
The other key thing that while we're talking about pathophysiology to be aware of is the biphasic reaction. Now, this is essentially where you get a second anaphylactic hit several hours after the first one. I was always taught when I was at med school that it's about 20% of patients had a biphasic reaction, which is quite high. But actually, the new sort of evidence suggests it's around sort of 4-5%. So it's not as high as we previously thought, which is good news. Should we talk about some causes? Liz, do you want to kick us off with the causes of anaphylaxis?
Bee stings.
Straight in there.
Okay. Classic. Bees and wasps, actually.
Penicillin.
That's a little bit creepy.
Was that a penicillin? Not a
penicillin.
Penicillin. So yeah, antibiotics in general, they're quite a big common cause, aren't they?
Non-steroids you see quite frequently as well. Actually, someone's just taken some ibuprofen. That's one of that.
Nutella.
Yeah, peanuts, yes.
Hazelnuts in Nutella.
Oh.
But nuts.
Just go nuts then.
Nuts in general.
Nuts. And always nuts.
Other foods like eggs or seafood, shellfish. Yeah.
Blood products, quite often, isn't it?
That's a really good shout, actually. In theory, any drug can cause anaphylaxis. So in theory, things like, like paracetamol could cause anaphylaxis. So key causes, in summary, foods, medications, antibiotics. Those are your big ones, aren't they?
Bees. Can you tell I'm allergic to bees? Thankfully, I haven't had an anaphylactic reaction.
Signs and symptoms: lip and tongue swelling, angioedema, nasal congestion, tightness of throat, hoarse throat, and stridor.
So those are all your airway symptoms, aren't they?
Breathing problems. Go, Matt.
Sorry. Right, yeah, I'm not really paying attention. So tachypnea, high respiratory rate. As you mentioned before, from the pathophysiology, you get that bronchospasm, so you get the wheeze as well. That's particularly prominent in patients who have got asthma or COPD underlying, anyway, particularly asthma, where there's often a degree of allergy ongoing. You can get a lot of secretions as well, so they might need a bit of suctioning. So particularly in kids, you often just have a snotty, very snotty anaphylactic child, which is pretty grim, but most kids are pretty grim anyway. And later signs that you're going to start to see some cyanosis from the hypoxia. You're going to start to get a little bit confused and a little bit agitated again because of the hypoxia. And you can have respiratory arrests as well towards the end stage, but hopefully you've got some appropriate treatment.
And then your circulatory problems, you've got your hypotension, your tachycardia, arrhythmias can occur as well. You can get some myocardial ischemia and cardiac arrest if you haven't managed to treat it before then. Sort of alongside those things causes that real anxiety.
A feeling of death and doom.
A sense of impending doom.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun.
But yeah, no, very grim for patients to experience that.
You don't write that off. It's a really clear sign.
Yeah, not. It's just a sign someone's unwell, isn't it? We've all in our practice seen somebody who thinks they're going to die. And more often than not, they either do die or they get pretty close to dying. Yeah. Whether it's a PE, whether it's arrhythmia or something. Chest pain, yeah. Trust them. If they say they feel like they're going to die, take them seriously. I suppose one of the key ones is the skin changes, isn't it?
You get urticaria and pruritus. Itchy skin and lots of blotches and hives and wheals. Yes, that's it. Skin or mucosal changes alone are not a sign of anaphylactic reaction. They can be subtle or absent in up to 20% of reactions.
And don't miss anaphylaxis just because they haven't got a rash.
I think that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the amount, if you've got somebody who's hypotensive, they might not have an airway problem. Hypotension might just be the only feature of anaphylaxis. If it's sudden onset, it is therefore in keeping with the definition from the rhesus catcher, which is that severe sudden onset airway breathing circulation problem.
And that's where getting a history is really important early on there. If they're really hypotensive, have there been any triggers?
Another less normal symptoms are stomach cramps, nausea, vomiting and diarrhea, particularly if you've just eaten something that you're allergic to. Management is following the Rhesus Council's 2021 guideline for anaphylaxis. And what do we do for every patient that we treat that's acutely ill?
A, B, C, D, E. Call for help. And in this case, lay your patient flat.
And that's one of the key changes in the 21 update is to emphasise actually we should be laying patients flat.
Although it does say if their breathing is really affected and laboured, being partially sat up may be beneficial. If they're pregnant, don't lie them flat. Lie them on the left side to stop compression of the inferior vena cava.
That's not just for anaphylaxis.
That's for any pregnant lady.
Pregnant women who are shocked or have, lay them on their left side, just reduce that pressure.
As soon as possible, remove the trigger. So stop any infusion and remove it. Don't throw it away because you might need to send it off for analysis, especially if it's a blood product or a drug. Make sure you keep the lot numbers. First of all, you want to do A. If they've got any signs of airway problems and issues, then you need to treat them straight away. So pop on the oxygen, call for help.
We don't even move on to breathing, do we?
No, not if we have to do something about the airway.
And we're going to give them some adrenaline, aren't we? So we're going to give adrenaline, wait 5 minutes, and give further adrenaline if we need to, and fuel spolus if necessary.
And what dose do we use?
It's 1 in 1,000. For an adult, it's 0.5 mils. 500 micrograms.
Yeah, 500 micrograms, yeah. Intramuscular, in the anterior lateral aspect of the proximal thigh.
And a really quick way of working that out, if you can't work out where the middle of the thigh on the upper outer quadrant is, hand width away from the hip, a hand width away from the knee, about halfway between there. Line down the middle of the top of your leg, line down the middle of the side of your leg, and it's in that upper outer quadrant that you want it. Children aged 6 to 12, it's 300 micrograms or 0.3 of a mil. And then for children 6 months to 6 years, it's 150 micrograms. And then they've got the new section in, the new guidelines. for children under the age of 6 months, that's just between 100 and 150 micrograms.
Always check that, though, isn't it? I think that's one of the key messages. The guideline is great, but having the guideline in there and having those doses written out, writing that dose for a kid, which is a very stressful situation to be in, always check your guidelines. Don't try and commit them to memory. You will just forget.
Hopefully every good anaphylaxis pack should have it written on the outside of the pack.
Then. With the majority of patients suffering an anaphylactic reaction, they're going to come round reasonably quickly once you've given the adrenaline. It's very few that get a refractory response. Mm. And if they do, there's another algorithm for that.
Ideally, you would have definitely called for help by that stage. And that's one of the keys, isn't it? At the top of the algorithm, do your ABCDE, call for help, get your help there, give your adrenaline. If you happen to give a second adrenaline, that's about 5 minutes afterwards, and you know, that's a doctor's
you
5 minutes.
You should definitely have help on the way by
exactly,
the
If you're giving two doses of adrenaline and help hasn't arrived, call for help again.
And then just keep giving the adrenaline every 5 minutes, don't you, until that help has arrived. And you're only going to give that IM, you want somebody, before you're going to go down the IV route.
And do make sure you've stopped the trigger. IV fluids?
Yeah, so IV fluids used to be one of the mainstays of the old algorithm. But in the new update, there's a sort of a de-escalation of it, and there's a de-escalation of a lot of the drugs that we'll talk about as well shortly. But certainly fluids in the guideline, in the algorithm, it recommends only giving it after that first 5 minutes. I don't think it's wrong to give fluids after that first dose of adrenaline. I think it's always better to make sure your patient's well-filled. We know that adrenaline pirates its action on alpha receptors. We know it's very good at causing mass vasoconstriction. That's why it helps with the laryngeal edema, why it helps with that airway swelling. It's also got some beta action as well, so that's why it helps with the wheeze. Pharmacologically, it's the best thing to give. But I always think if you're going to be squeezing somebody, you want to make sure that actually they've got a good volume already. So I would have a low threshold personally to give a fluid bolus. The algorithm talks about giving after 5 minutes. That's what you should be doing. Mm. But don't be scared of giving fluids.
But there's no point squeezing an empty patient.
Exactly.
So you're going to give, 500 to 1,000 mils?
Yeah, I give 500 bolus in an adult, or 10 mils per kilo in a child. And if I need to give more than that with appropriate adrenaline doses, then I think that's fine too. The other big change is the use of steroids. So we used to give steroids quite liberally. There was a thought that it reduced the biphasic, or the risk of having a biphasic reaction. There's actually no real evidence to support that. So the 2021 update has removed steroid use routinely. So we don't routinely use steroids. There are a couple of caveats that we can use that in. Essentially, if the patient is refractory, if they've had sort of severe biphasic reactions in the past, then we can consider giving steroids. But there's a move away from, or the move towards, just thinking about adrenaline, oxygen, bit of fluid if you need it, but mainly lying flat, calling for help, giving adrenaline. Those are the three key things that the Rhesus Council want us to take away.
Yeah, you might use steroids for asthmatics as well.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. There's no significant evidence of harm in anaphylaxis.
No.
So actually even giving steroids in anaphylaxis probably isn't doing much harm, but the thought is that it actually takes you or your team away from giving adrenaline. And focusing on that stuff, which we know is the life-saving stuff. So that's why there's a de-escalation of steroids.
What about the antihistamines? Would they not be beneficial in treatment of symptoms?
Beneficial for treatment of the itch, but not as first-line drugs anymore. So once you've got them stabilised and sorted, then you can worry about their itch. And that's a change away from the IV clofenamine as well, and to just an oral non-steroidal.
Salbutamol used to be part of the anaphylaxis.
Okay, so again, limited or no real evidence that salbutamol is effective in anaphylaxis. Sometimes it's effective if you have asthma and have anaphylaxis or asthma and allergy. And there was never any evidence that it was used. But again, it's sometimes helpful if patients have got symptomatic wheeze. The adrenaline is going to fix that wheeze, though. So again, a move away from using salbutamol.
So there's something about mast cell tryptase as well.
It can be measured in the blood. And it reaches the peak concentration approximately 1 to 2 hours post-reaction. So the ideal recommendation is to take 3 tryptase samples immediately, a second one 1 to 2 hours post-reaction, but not more than 4 hours post-reaction. And then you can take a third at 24 hours period post-anaphylactic reaction.
But the go-to is take those 3 samples, one immediately, one at sort of 1 to 2 hours post, one at 24 hours. The reality of doing that in the modern NHS, you know, the patient probably won't be in normally the emergency department. If you're an inpatient and you're on a you know, you're in for a different reason, you happen to have an episode of anaphylaxis, then you can probably facilitate that with phlebotomist the next day and ward cover and night cover and all those sorts of things. If you come into the emergency department, you can do the immediate one, you can do the one a couple of hours post. Bringing them back the next day to do another blood test is inappropriate for emergency department. Getting this booking with a GP for a blood test the next day, very
impossible.
Almost impossible. So actually that third blood test is often missed. There is a recognition of that. And as long as, from an immunologist's point of view, as long as you have at least one, ideally two, because you want to see a rise and a fall of the mast cell tryptase. So I think as long as you take two and they're sensibly spaced out as per the guidelines, that's better than taking none. The observation period has changed. We used to keep patients for hours, 6 to 12 hours, because of this risk of biphasic reactions, which we now know is less. So there's some patients we can consider for a fast-track discharge, i.e. about 2 hours after the resolution of anaphylaxis. Those are patients that have a good response to one dose of adrenaline, complete resolution of symptoms. They have adrenaline auto-injectors available and know how to use them, and they have adequate supervision. So those patients can often be discharged within a couple of hours, which is good. Some patients you might want to keep for about 6 hours are those that have required two doses of adrenaline or have had previous biphasic reactions. You just want to make sure that you don't discharge them home and need them to come back in a heap. And then there's other patients that you're probably going to keep for at least 12 hours. Now, these are patients that have severe reactions requiring more than two doses of adrenaline, in which case you're going to be using the refractory anaphylaxis guideline. Patients who have severe asthma or severe sort of respiratory issues, you're going to keep them for a little bit longer too. Sometimes if you're taking a slow release medication or if you're taking a lot of stuff orally, you might want to keep those patients for a bit longer because it increases that risk of a biphasic reaction. The two most sensible things, I think, in this guideline are the final 2 points, that actually if a patient presents late at night or if they're in areas where it's difficult to get to emergency departments, then actually they should be observed for 12 hours too. Mm-hmm. And that's just good, sort of sensible,
clinical practice.
Yeah, good clinical practice. Nothing medical about that, nothing physiological. That's
good old-fashioned common sense.
It's just
good
common medicine, sense, isn't it? Absolutely. So when we're discharging these patients, we do need to think about making sure they've got two adrenaline auto-injectors and know how to use them, as we've already mentioned. We also need to make sure that they've got verbal and written advice about what to do if they have another reaction. And if it's their first time, we want to make sure that we've done those mast cell tryptases and we've sent a referral to an allergy clinic so they can be followed up. If it's not their first time, which actually is quite common, we have a lot of patients who have recurrent anaphylaxis, then actually don't need to refer them to an allergy clinic. Just make sure they've got their adrenaline injectors and they know how to use them.
And that they're in date still, because they have quite a short expiry date. Just remember, beware any patient who has a severe sudden onset of life-threatening airway breathing circulation problems who may or may not have associated skin problems. Key changes from the previous guidelines: adrenaline, adrenaline, adrenaline is the main message to take home. Lie that patient down sooner rather than later. There's the emergency protocol, but there's also the refractory protocol as well.